Podcast. We're back again for yet another consecutive week. I'm Chris Shunk, and joined with me today are Dan Roth. What's going on, Dan?
How you doing?
And Sam Abulasamid.
Hey, it's cold here.
And we've got the Chief, John Knapp. What's going on, John?
How much? Great to be here.
All right, guys, we've got plenty to talk about this week. As always, though, we're going to start with the Autoblog Garage. And Sam, what do you have?
Got F-150 Platinum sitting out in the driveway. And it's big and uses slightly less gas than the Tahoe that just went away.
Is that the same model that I had, the white one?
No, this is a black one. And I'm surprised. I would have thought that in the Platinum, the nav system would be standard, but apparently it's not, because this one doesn't have a nav in it.
Yeah, I'm actually writing up the review right now for the Platinum I had, and I didn't know that it wasn't standard until I actually started putting the options together on the Ford website.
Yeah, the rest of the truck is pretty nice. I mean, you know, for a big full-size truck, you know, it rides pretty well, and, doing all right, you know, at 14 miles per gallon, but this thing is huge.
Apparently it gets better fuel economy than any other truck in its class after the Mike Rowe video we watched on Autoblog the other day.
At least until the hybrid Sierra and Silverado come out this spring. Those will be they're supposed to be about 20 miles per gallon with it's the same two-mode hybrid system that's in the SUVs.
Yeah, but the F-150 is still going to be cheaper.
Right.
It'll be a lot cheaper. Well, unless you go for the Platinum.
People will actually have to buy the hybrid Silverado, so we'll see if that happens this time. Well, all right, John, do you have anything right now?
Yeah, I have the Mitsubishi Outlander for one more day. And it's a 2009 model, but I actually went back, you know, to in our archives to see if we had reviewed one, to see if I should review this one. And we did. Two or three years ago, it was like a 2006 or 2007 model. And what I noticed is that even though mine's a brand new one with like, you know, less than 2,000 miles on it, it's literally the exact same vehicle we reviewed 2 or 3 years ago. And they haven't really done anything to it in terms of, you know, tweaks, redesigns, adding content. It's the exact same vehicle. So I'm probably going to write the review based around, you know, the vehicle hasn't changed, but the entire segment has changed around it, and because obviously there's a lot better CUVs around now than there were 2 or 3 years ago. So it's nice, though. I like it. It's a lot sportier handling than I expected from a CUV. Really, it's not light on its feet, but it changes direction well and feels planted. It's almost got a firm ride that when I got in, it kind of felt like a truck until you kind of take a turn, and instead of, you know, bouncing the rear end off the road, it kind of plants itself, which, like I said, strange for a CUV, but I'm liking it so far. It's leaving tomorrow, so.
Somebody says Mitsubishi Outlander, I think of that commercial where that movie theater guy who's now dead says the Mitsubishi Outlander.
I'm like, LaFontaine.
Yeah, that guy, he died, man. It's kind of spooky when you see the commercials now. Dan, you have anything?
I still got the Escalade Hybrid. I did figure out that the problem I was having last week with Nav is the fact that it doesn't have the map disk in it, so it won't load the map.
I gotta hate it when that happens.
Yeah, but other than that,
So is the Nav useless then without the disk?
Yeah, it shows a compass, and that's great. That's wonderful.
Awesome. Does it at least show you your coordinates?
No, I don't. Well, I don't think so. I haven't, you know, I haven't really played with that much, but I still think it's kind of an obscene amount of money for what you get. It's nice. It drives real nice for what it is. You know, I think the GMT 900s have really good steering feel, really solid platform. But, you know, you look around a little bit and you go,
really? You think that's got good steering feel? Because
for what it is, I do,
Tahoe,
yeah.
And it had, you know, the steering was way too light, and there was zero feedback.
Well,
I think the Escalade was a little bit better. I had both, and I thought it was a little better, and I had the two mode for both of them too.
Let me temper my statement by saying, you know, the I haven't been in the new F-150 or the Ram, so I can't really speak to how those go down the road. But in general, for a vehicle this large, a body-on-frame truck, I think they drive really quite well, and I'm sure that the Escalade has, you know, the best sway bars and suspension calibration they can put in the GMT 900. So,
yeah, I mean,
I've been impressed by how it drives.
And there's no slop in the steering like there used to be, you know, a few years
ago. Right? Yeah.
But thinking of the old Tahoes,
you know, it's a little numb, but I expect the numbness from a large vehicle like that, so that doesn't bother me so much. What does bother me, though, is you look around and you go, okay, it's not really any nicer than a Denali, and it's, you know, how much more, or even a luxed-up Tahoe. You know, most of the interior trim pieces are probably the same thing you're going to find on the lesser siblings, you know, and it's not bad. It all presents well. But for $75,000 for the Cadillac, you know, it's a little bit
disappointing. I think what it is, GM's trying to make up some of the money they're losing on all the other two-mode trucks, you know, which is a lot.
Yeah. But, you know, none of it's offensive. It's just it kind of, you know, for other $75,000 trucks, they're trimmed a little nicer. But, you know, in general, I found the hybrid system to work very well, and overall, I like it.
Right now, I have the Mazda 6 Touring. Still.
Now you still have that.
Yep, and it goes away on... we did the last podcast on Wednesday, so it's only been 5 days. But, I like it a lot. It's the handling is terrific. I can't wait. I'm driving the Mazda or the Ford Fusion Sport right after it. So I'm going to go from one sporty edition with the 3.7 to the 3.5 from Ford. I love the handling. I like the looks. I've actually kind of worn on the looks a little bit since I've been driving it. The one thing that I'm disappointed in is that the manual shift mode is the slowest manual shift mode I've ever used. I mean, you have to time it like literally 3/4 of a second before you want it to shift. You have to hit the, you know, notch it over before you actually want it to shift. It's a long time.
Do you find that the 3.7 is as revvy as the 3.5? I noticed that the 3.5, you kind of had to wind it up to get some of the snap out of it. And I wonder if just a little bit extra displacement is going to make it
more torquey. It's got plenty of torque. I think it's got about 20 foot-pounds more of torque. You could notice it when you're driving it. It's not a lot more horsepower. It's mostly torque. And when you're like at the low end, you could really notice it. And when you take off at the line right away, you go. The problem is after you're out of first gear, then if you want to go in manual shift mode, it's going to take forever. I mean, first gear, it's instant. And then after that, it's just the longest delay. I don't know what the problem is with that.
No, the problem is you're supposed to leave it in auto and let it do the shifting for you.
It seems like something you want to do, and then you do it, and you don't really want to do it. So
yeah, right. It's like it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Have you ever used like a manumatic transmission in something below $40,000 that's not a dual clutch that you've like wanted to use on a regular basis?
No, never. And not above $40,000 either. The only type of those kind of transmissions I've been very impressed with is the
DSG
Volkswagen's DSG. Yeah,
right. The dual clutch ones.
Those are phenomenal. Yeah,
I'll give you two examples of why manumatics are stupid. One, you could say, like, the Outlander I have right now has it, and it has paddle shifters that are actually really good. They're the kind that are attached to the steering column, and they're really tall, so that when you turn the wheel, your fingers can pretty much touch them wherever they are. But at the same time, it's a CUV. Why would I need that or want that on such a vehicle? But then you move to an even more ludicrous example, which was the rental Town and Country minivan.
Yes, that was my favorite.
It didn't have paddle shifters. It had
the little switches on the back of the steering.
It didn't have that either. What it had was it has the shifter. Really up high on the dash. Like it's not in a center column.
It's almost a console or a column mount. It's like a column mounted shifter, but it's on the dash.
Right. It's like exactly. To the right of the gauge pod.
That is by far the goofiest ever.
It's not in any place where you would naturally rest your hand, and you put it into drive, you know, you move it down four slots, and then then to the left and right are actual, you know, upshift and downshifts. You know, it has, so you can manually upshift or downshift. And I'm like, are you serious?
And you have to you have to lean forward to actually do it. So there's no like comfortably doing it while you're sitting back in your seat. You actually have to like remove your back from the seat back to actually to move forward to do
to
it.
Touch this thing. Actually, yeah. It's like not only is it so inappropriate in a vehicle of this type, it's also it could not be ergonomically worse to use. Like, why would you even waste the money to put that in there?
Yeah,
the Tahoe that you have.
What's that, Dan?
Go ahead.
The
I was just going to ask you if the...
Go ahead. You go.
No, go.
No, you go.
I insist.
Dan, go.
All right,
seriously.
The one crossover I've ever had that had paddles that actually it seemed that it didn't seem out of place was the Infiniti FX50. You know, that thing had the 7-speed automatic, and it, like you said, John, on the Outlander, it's got the big long paddles that are mounted on the column. Yeah, so as mm-hmm. you turn the wheel, you can still tap them, and that one worked really well. It had nice crisp shifts.
Yeah, and like I said, the one in the Outlander works pretty well. I'm sure it doesn't shift as quickly as something like the Infiniti, and it's really not powerful enough to kind of have fun with it. But at least it was mechanically a good design for it. But like I said, I don't think I've ever used a Manumatic, you know, self shifting transmission like on a regular basis. I turn it on to try it and I'm like, okay, that's fun, back to auto.
Although I do have to say the Infiniti, if you want that type of thing, it's really tough to beat the way Infiniti does it. Their transmission's pretty responsive.
Yeah, I'm sure some are better than others, some are quicker than others, but then you get into a Volkswagen or Audi with DSG, or, you know, if you can afford one, a Porsche with their PDK. And then it's over. I mean, you experience that, and you're like, why isn't every transmission like this? You get everything that's great about an automatic, and shifts that are so crisp and so direct. You know, better than you can do yourself with a manual.
It'll be interesting to see if Ford puts paddles or offers paddles on the Fiesta when it debuts at the end of the year, because that's going to have a dual clutch gearbox like the DSG.
I would hope so, because you look at something like the Jetta TDI, which you can get with the DSG, and that's great, but it doesn't have paddles at all.
Right, you have to use the console shifter for that one.
The console shifter, which takes a lot of fun out of it. I'd much rather use paddles than a console.
Isn't that kind of like arguing that like changing the channel with the remote with your right hand versus using your left hand? I mean, the console shift isn't like a far reach or anything. It's
no, but it just doesn't. No. It does, you know, just doing the tap forward and back with the console shifter.
It's a fake motion.
It doesn't seem as natural. Not to mention,
so the fake motion of paddles not connected to anything is fine, but the fake motion of the stick not connected to anything is.
If we're getting into like the feel of it, though, it's like when I'm watching racing on TV, and they're like that's a connection to like a function that actual race cars use. You know. Paddle shifters. There's a purpose for that and a reason they have them there. But just to like artificially make the console shifter go left and right in a gate, that's just mimicking, you know, what an actual manual does in a poor way, because you're just tapping it left and right. I mean, you're basically doing this grand fake motion to push a button. That's all it's doing.
Do you remember the steering column mounted shifters that were the actual manual transmissions on the old vans and such?
Yeah, uh-huh. Like the three on the tree.
Yeah, how about something like that? And then you like just you cut it off, and then you put like the handle of a baseball bat in there. That's what we did with my buddy's truck. He had a Dodge Ram, and he had the shifter. It was a 3-speed, and he sawed off the bat, the Louisville Slugger, and we put it in there, and it looked pretty cool. On that note, huh? Let's talk about something else. all right, we had a pretty busy week. Already a lot of good stuff happening. Well, now you say good stuff in terms of things to report. First off, we have the EPA, the duality. Let's talk about the new rules. Mr. Obama is basically saying that the states should look into getting their own, specifically California, getting their own EPA rules. Dan, you know a little bit more about this than I do, so why don't you go ahead?
Well, essentially, California can pass their own emission standards because they're kind of grandfathered in the sense that they started coming up with emissions and economy standards before the federal government did. So they're allowed to do it, but they still need a waiver from the EPA. And back in, I think it was 2007, the Bush administration denied a waiver to California to increase its fuel economy and emission standards. So they're back at it again. They want to get that waiver so that they can push their standards through, and all the states that the states can basically pick two standards. You can pick a federal standard, or you can pick the California standard. You can't have 50 differing standards. And I guess that's where a little confusion came into the post.
The problem is, Dan, that you know, California was the first one to do emission standards, but they've never had the power to do fuel efficiency standards, and they've never actually tried to mandate fuel efficiency standards separately in California from the federal government. It's always been strictly emission standards. And, you know, they did it before the Clean Air Act was passed. And so, you know, they've always had a right under the Clean Air Act to do more stringent standards than the federal government because of air quality problems that they have, particularly in Southern California. But now, you know, where the issue is coming up now is California wants to regulate CO2 emissions.
Right, which is a de facto mileage standard.
Exactly. And, you know, because they've never had the right to set mileage standards separately from the federal government, you know, now they're effectively doing that with CO2 emission standards. And so that's where everybody's starting to complain. And you're right, you know, there are only, you know, technically the federal and California standards. But the problem is some states have been, you know, some of the states that are in the so-called California group, have been cherry picking. You know, they're not taking the complete California standards. They're taking bits and pieces of it and implementing that in their states. And
right.
So
it makes a mess.
Yeah.
It's
well, and you know, every state that that deviates from the federal standards, you know, then the car makers, all the car makers, not just the Detroit car makers, but you know, the Japanese, the Germans, everybody, have to go into those states and test and certify their vehicles, you know, for those states. You know, and different states have different requirements, you know, reporting requirements. You know, there, you know, some states will say, you know, if you're certified in California, you're good here. Others are doing, you know, they're doing different things. So there may only be, you know, strictly speaking, two standards, but as far as the documentation and all the bureaucracy, it does get a lot more complicated and adds a lot of cost.
Well, see, it just really strikes me that this is going to be, you know, we gave them some bailout funds. Really, this is one area where we could try to maximize the effectiveness of those funds and just, you know, bring in a single federal standard, because it's just going to eat up money to do all of these different configurations. And, you know, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have stricter standards or whatever. You know, let's come to a consensus about what the standard should be, and it's obviously going to be a compromise, and that's fine. And we do already have a strict standard that they're working on meeting in the very near future. And, you know, just looking at California's upcoming standard, it's a little bit insane. You know, unless somebody introduces, you know, a cold fusion powered vehicle, it's just, you know, it's going to be really tough to meet, and we're going to get, you know, smaller vehicles that cost a lot more. And it's funny, I was watching the news hour on PBS a little bit this afternoon, and they had some commentators on there, and one of the fellows from our lovely state of Massachusetts.
Boo! Okay, go ahead.
Yes, which has California emissions. One of the statements he made was, well, they've got these kind of fuel-efficient small vehicles in the rest of the world. Why are we missing out on them here? And then you go, well, because of our crash regulations, where our vehicles are by nature larger and heavier because they have to be to get all these crash star, you know, star crash ratings, and that makes them less efficient. And then there's the emission standards that kind of piggyback on that. So there's a lot of impediments.
I think the bigger issue is the fact that, you know, in the rest of the world, they've been paying $6-$7 a gallon for fuel, you know, for a long, long time, whereas, you know, we've been paying $1.50 to $2 a gallon at most up until,
right,
you know, the last year and a half or so. And, you know,
so
it's
there's the
down,
argument
comes
then
down to consumer demand.
And there's also, right, there's also the point that people in, for example, Great Britain are willing to spend $25,000 on a C-segment vehicle like a Focus, while here in the United States, I mean, you have to be something special to be small and cost a lot of money.
Hey,
there's
very few
examples.
That $25,000 price for a car like the Focus, that also includes, you know, like a 17 or 18% value added tax, because the prices that they quote there and that they advertise include the VAT, which you don't get here. You know, the prices you see here don't include sales taxes. So you got to, you know, chop 16, 17, 18% off the top right there. So the actual price of the car itself is not, I mean, yeah, it tends to be more, but it's not as extreme as, you know, as that, as those prices may make it appear.
Wow, they really punish you over there for owning a car, don't they?
Well, it's not just, yeah, but it's just not that, just on cars, it's on everything, though.
And really, what they're doing, they're shaping consumer demand. When you have that much of a tax on fuel, that instantly changes consumer demand towards smaller, more fuel-efficient cars. Whereas right. In the U.S., the government seems to be trying to force or heavily influence the automakers to build and sell these extremely fuel-efficient and expensive cars without providing the demand, without influencing right. The demand.
How are you going to sell... How like are you going to sell a $40,000 Fusion? You know, I don't care that it gets 50 miles per gallon or whatever.
You don't have to sell a $40,000 Fusion to get 40 miles per gallon.
No, well, I know you don't, but you got to understand that kind of...
$80,000 pickup truck if you're going to get the kind of...
Right, yeah, but if you want a pickup truck that gets 40 miles per gallon, it's going to cost you a lot of money. But
they want a pickup truck to get essentially 26.6.
The market has to change. I mean, you know, that's the problem. That's the thing that automakers have been fighting for the last several years. You know, if you don't do something about the cost of fuel in this country, you know, people want their big heavy vehicles, and you know, to make those big heavy vehicles meet the fuel economy standards, then yeah, it costs a hell of a lot of money. But right. If the price of fuel is higher, then you know, people tend to gravitate to smaller, more efficient vehicles naturally when fuel is more expensive, and so the demand for those big heavy vehicles just naturally evaporates.
Right, but it's a thorny issue because there's the other side of the argument that says you know, higher taxes on fuel is going to disproportionately hurt the poor or those of lesser income versus, you know, the people who can afford right, the there, big expensive
ways,
vehicles
there's
now.
Way, there's so. Ways you can compensate for that though by, you know, okay, if you raise the fuel taxes, you make adjustments in things like payroll taxes. You change the way payroll taxes are done, so you exempt, you know, say the first $15,000 of income from payroll taxes and raise the cap on that. You know, so right. You know, because the payroll tax is, you know, ridiculously regressive as it is today anyway. But you know, we don't need to go there right now. But
nobody understands it, so
there's ways to compensate for that.
It just seems like the bigger issue here is that this is a big issue. It's intertwined with the rest of the economy, and it's not something that just, you know, California picking some numbers is going to fix.
Right.
Let's go back to the original intent of the law that allowed California to do this in the first place. When the federal government allowed California to make its own emission standards, it was because the air quality in California, and particularly the LA area, was so bad it was considered an emergency.
It was about smog. It wasn't about CO2.
Right. What I'd like to know is, has that problem been contained?
No.
Literally,
have you looked out the window when we go to the LA Auto Show, John?
Well, I didn't go last year, but but you know, it's like, what if California needed it for those reasons? That was to help California, and the loophole that caused all of this was the addendum that. Any other states, if you wanted to adopt California's laws, you could. And now that's exploded into this thing where there's this two-tier system, and you can pick one or the other, and states are kind of choosing which aspects they want to pick. And really, that's not going to... I've heard people argue that's going to be better for the automakers in the long run because they'll have more fuel-efficient lineups. But really, what the government should be facilitating is a simpler market for the cars and trucks that these automakers have to sell. And we've said this before, but by increasing the gas tax and thereby increasing demand for fuel efficient vehicles would help, and also to temporarily adopt the emissions and safety standards of Europe so that those lineups could be shared. Those would be simplifying kind of the structure of the markets
for the automakers, John, and helping. That will never happen for a couple reasons, because for one, the auto industry is America's stepchild. Everybody wants to regulate it. They want to tell it what to do, but they never want to pay for anything to make it happen. And for example, and this is an example I've used before, but a lot of people don't know this, but there are absolutely zero regulations on cigarettes. and we spend $100 billion a year in health insurance that's directly related, 100% related to smoking and smoking related illnesses. In cars, there is a lot. There are accidents, but the accidents have not gone down. They're not preventing accidents. They're just the small amount of people that are getting that before were dying in the accident are now just maimed for life, right? And but it's costing billions of dollars, and that's one of those the more progressive things that they've done with the auto industry. But with regards to this, this is going to cost billions. But it's such a small drop in the bucket. The fuel economy. This what it's going to do to the automakers. It's going to make them chase their tails. And with diesel engines, there are going to be cars that won't be sold in California for years.
And the other states that
yeah, we're talking about up to like 18 states total.
It's about one half of the market. One half of the U.S. Population. So there are some things that I'm wondering, like, for example, like what other countries do for pickup trucks. Because I don't see pickup trucks.
They have smaller trucks.
They don't buy them.
They just don't buy them. Yeah, gas is too expensive.
North America is the only place where you see any significant number of people buying big pickup trucks and SUVs.
Right. I if that happens in the next 5 years, the automakers are going to have to, in Detroit especially, are going to have to take such a drastic shift in the way they make cars. I think it's going to take a very healthy market for it to actually happen.
If this goes through, what's going to happen is that there's going to be a race, probably by the Japanese, Honda or Toyota, to become the first automaker to sell California-compliant cars in all 50 states. Like, they're going to be, this is going to be a race to a PR victory if this all goes down.
Yeah, actually, don't count Hyundai out of that race either.
I wouldn't count Hyundai, and honestly, I wouldn't count Ford out either.
Because the focus is, the Fiesta, I bet, is going to beat it off the bat. And I'm sure the Cruze will do pretty close as well.
Yeah, because these automakers, they obviously do not want to make two versions of every vehicle they sell for each half of the country. They know it's expensive to build for the California one, but if you can be the first one to do it, that's a huge PR score. And Sam, you're right. I think Hyundai is probably in the best spot, mainly because they don't really have a giant SUV or a giant truck.
Yeah,
they
could probably be the fullest.
Right, they could probably be...
It's the Borrego.
But they could probably be the first to say, you know, our entire lineup is California compliant.
Yeah, but, you know, what I don't understand here is like, if you're, on the government level, if you're, you know, it doesn't make any sense. If you're going to lend money to, like, if you know, John, you were to come to me and say,
can I have $1 million? You're talking about government and making sense.
It's mental midgetry at its best. I mean,
but if you're going to lend money to an industry so that it can try to survive, why are you then going to turn around and
shoot it in the head?
Right,
like,
exactly.
That's literally what they're doing.
You know, I understand the need for emission standards. I understand the idea that, it, you know, the smog is still not cured. It's a lot better. I understand that, you know, the vehicles in the 60s would give you a freaking headache if you stood next to them, even in the driveway. So things have gotten better, and they could still get better. But right now, it doesn't make any sense to make it any more difficult and cost any more untold dollars. I mean, the vehicles now, you'd have a very difficult time killing yourself with a modern car. And new cars aren't the problem.
Especially when, you know, the last energy bill that was passed and is going into law does contain significant increases in, you know, emissions and fuel economy standards. So it's not like, you know, the California crowd can say, you know, the federal government isn't doing anything. No, it is, but apparently it's just not fast enough for you because the end of the world is much nearer than
it's got to be done in 4 years. I mean, that's it. We have 4 years to save the world, and that's it.
Do they have a group of scientists in California or in these states where they're going to adopt these separate emissions? Sam, you could probably answer. Is there a group of scientists that are working with the auto industry to say what is feasible? You know, look at this from the outside in, and I want to look at your plans and say, this is what you guys have at your disposal. And we think, without actually talking to the automakers, besides gathering from suppliers and the automakers what they can and can't do, that this is actually doable. Because if I'm a senator, okay, if I'm Dianne Feinstein, and I'm like, well, you know what? I'd like to see 50. I want 50. You know what? No.
She has said stuff like that.
I want 70 miles per gallon.
The answer to your question is no. Nope. You know, the politicians generally are not looking at what's technically, and it's not just a matter of technical feasibility, but a combination of technical and economic feasibility. You know, it's like, you know, what can you do, and what can you do that people can actually afford to buy? You know, because I mean, right.
What can you do that the automakers can afford to develop?
You know, I'm sure we'd all love to have Mr. Fusions under the hood of our cars, but that's just not going to happen for the price.
Well, speak for yourself, Dan.
Anybody's going to be able to pay.
There goes Dan talking about the Fusion again. We know you love it. Stop it.
You know, and let's be very careful and clear about what has happened. President Obama has requested that the EPA reconsider.
Right.
Granting the waiver.
Yeah, I mean, nothing's actually been made yet.
Yeah, the ball is in the EPA's court, and the EPA could, while the EPA, you know, has the new director, who I believe was picked by Obama, but,
yes.
You know, it has the opportunity, and it may very well look at California's request and say, you know, we can grant you a waiver, but not to do this. You know,
it's expected to pass the waiver. For this measure,
I've also read that the EPA could very well say that, you know, it's granted with these caveats. A, you can't go to this extent because it's impossible. Right. Well, the automakers cannot do this and survive.
The thing is, the EPA granted the waiver back in 2007, and the then administrator Stephen Johnson changed the decision. He made the call in spite of what his staff, you know, said. The EPA staff wanted to grant the waiver, and Johnson made the decision after consulting with the White House not to, you know, to deny the waiver.
Well, I just don't, the other thing I don't understand is, why is it so punitive? Why are we so punitive to the automotive industry? What about power plants and ships and all of the other industries that use massive amounts of energy?
Think about computers. Everybody leaves their computer on 24 hours a day.
The
car industry is an easy whipping boy.
Yeah, it's the scapegoat.
And, you know, the thing is that the problem is the car industry has fought regulations, you know, for so many decades that they try to speak up now, you know, they're like they're the boy who cried wolf. You know,
although I did like to hear,
even if they're right, nobody takes them seriously anymore.
I did like to hear a couple months ago when it was announced the EPA is setting emission standards for like lawnmowers and certain farm equipment. Do you remember reading?
I think
Autoblog Green posted about that. So, I mean, you know, I've always, you know, in the summer when I'm mowing my lawn, kind of wondered, you know, why doesn't this thing have a catalytic converter or something like that? You know, why is it spewing black smoke and that's okay, but my car
because
has
to be... Because it costs a fortune to put platinum into tiny little catalytic converters, and basically the world is out of platinum, which that's another thing that nobody's saying. You know, we all want everything should be a hybrid is the thing that you hear over and over again. Well, where are we going to get all the exotic materials for the batteries? And then what about our grid? Everybody wants plug-in hybrids. What about our grid? You know, unless we figure out a way to actually redesign our grid, you know, they're talking about smart grids and everything. That's not going to happen in 4 years. Our grid is 100-something years old.
Right, and then you take into account that, you know, they want plug-in hybrids and the ability to achieve 50 miles per gallon, which I think in a lot of ways is screamed for plug-in hybrids. Where are we going to plug them in? I mean, they want like ultimate planning? Because I don't know if you noticed, but Americans aren't big planners. So, you know, where are we going to get the plugs? Where are we going to get the hydrogen infrastructure? Just pay for it up front and then give people something to shoot for.
We get hydrogen basically from oil right now. I don't think they're – I mean, I know electrolysis makes it as well.
Most of it comes from natural gas.
Yeah, I think most of it does. And
steam reformation and natural gas.
Right. And so, okay, you've got all these things and they're all very good – maturing technologies. So let's work on it, but let's not try to change, you know, the direction of things in an instant. You know, that's just, you know, to support more plug-in hybrids and just pure electric vehicles, we're going to need more power plants, and we're going to build more coal plants, and we're going to build nuclear plants. And then, so it's a big, huge ball of wax that, you know, boils down to right now, you look at the carbon and federal emissions fight, and you go, you know, you can just, you pull on one thread and the whole thing just starts to unravel. So,
well, I think the smartest direction at this point is there's so many kind of competing technologies for the next generation of fuel efficient vehicles that it's important to kind of support them all, let them all grow at a pace and see which one kind of gets into the lead. You know, I mean, nobody stepped out and helped the Honda Insight and the Toyota Prius when it first came out. They just hung around and then a need arose for them and their popularity exploded. Relatively speaking.
Right.
And I think the same thing can happen when, you know, you give all of these automakers a reason to create plug-in hybrids, not to, you know, make their entire lineup plug-in hybrids, but start offering them or start offering an all-electric vehicle and then have these competing technologies around. And one of them will find a niche and get in there and start to grow. And you'll find out what might be the next big
thing. That would be a great idea if the time constraints would allow itself to ferret out what the winner was. Because if you look at, for example, like the Prius, last September, they were still having issues with batteries, even though they're ramped up to 300,000 units and the thing's 10 years old. And it was what, Gen 2 of the hybrid battery? I mean, it takes them years to ramp this up. Now, you're talking about Barack Obama, President Obama, was on the radio. I don't know if he was also on TV. I heard him on the radio this morning saying that he wants to give the automakers direction. He wants to let them know where we're going, and he wants to have tougher emission standards for 2011. Now, anybody that knows word one about productions of vehicles knows that a year and a half's time is not sufficient time to plan for much stiffer regulations.
If they, dude, 2011 is set in stone right now.
It's already
2011 is over. We're into like late 2012 products
right
now.
And at
the very
this
earliest
is the problem. I mean, literally, there's 2010 models coming out in the next month. 2011 models will be coming out within a year and a couple weeks. And by not this summer, but the following summer, the entire model will be out. And this, we're talking about late 2012, like you guys said, 2013. And the stuff that's really going to count, I'm thinking, is going to come around 2013, 2014. That's what's going to be able to make it.
I think what Obama was actually referring to for 2011, though, Chris, was the first phase of the new CAFE rules, the corporate average fuel economy, which, you know, are supposed to take effect starting with the 2011 model year. And last year, the NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which is there's this bizarre split between EPA and NHTSA on all that, but NHTSA is actually responsible for setting the CAFE rules, and they released a draft of the new rules last spring, but those still haven't been finalized. So you know the automakers still don't know what they're actually going to have to meet for 2011 as far as fuel economy standards.
So was Obama just saying that he'd like to see them tougher than we expected,
well,
or
no,
higher than we expected?
Just that he wants them finalized.
Oh, okay. Just that he wants them finalized.
Yeah, because they still haven't been finalized.
But
yet.
Are they going to? Could
and
they
I
have
want
to grow? I mean, if they're not finalized, does that mean they could go back and say, you know what, we want an extra 2 miles per gallon for everything?
That's possible, but I think it's unlikely.
You know what? Nowadays, I have no idea what's likely anymore because there just doesn't seem to be any clear cut direction. It seems like they don't trust the auto industry. Because I'll give you a hint.
Well, and rightly, that's a fair thing not to trust the auto. I mean, historically, the auto industry has only done things when it's been forced to, kicking and screaming, either by the government or by public opinion forcing it
right.
to. So that's fine if you don't trust them to do their own thing. But if you're paying attention, you can see the court of public opinion forcing these automakers to make more fuel efficient vehicles. I mean, you look at Ford, who's doing everything it can to grab the top miles per gallon in every class it can. General Motors right behind. I mean, look at the Escape and the new Equinox, which are their four cylinder versions are battling for the title of, you know, the most fuel efficient the trucks are and all that. You know, the court of public opinion is moving this faster than the government,
right.
The funny
thing is, though, if you were to take, you know, do the old-fashioned way and vote on this and say, you know what, anybody who wants California emissions, they want this, you know, we're going to go to a higher standard, we're going to build, an electric infrastructure or a hydrogen infrastructure, we're going to do all this, it's only going to take a 30-cent per gallon gas tanks, you vote for it, you get it, who's going to vote for it? Is it going to win? I doubt it.
I vote for gas tax.
What's that?
I'd pay more for gas.
I would. Is the general public going to accept another 30 cents on gas?
Who knows?
But, because everybody wants cheap gas.
It's hypothetical, but I think we all have a good idea that the answer is no.
You know what? When you ask people if they're willing to pay that, you know, they'll almost invariably say no. But last summer when gas was $4 a gallon, you know, if you look at the way car sales were going at that time, you know, and what kind of cars were selling, you know, and Honda sold 53,000 Civics in June, and, you know, Ford was selling Focuses as fast as they could build them. You know, that did more.
Yeah,
that
the market more, adjusted.
Yeah, I mean, that the market responded based on what fuel was costing. Yeah,
and it just shows you that people are reacting.
Regulations to force more efficient vehicles.
Right, it all came from the price of gas.
Right,
which but as my dad will always tell me, you know, Jimmy Carter tried to raise the price of gas in his day, and he didn't get elected to a second term.
Well, that's why no politician
is going to come out and say, let's raise the price of gas.
I wish that was the only reason why Jimmy Carter didn't get reelected.
Well, yeah. My dad always qualifies with that, among other things. But
he did open up the UFO file, so God bless him for that.
Turn the thermostat down and wear a sweater.
And, you know, on top of all of this, I do want to be clear that, like, I disagree with President Obama kind of requesting the reconsidering this waiver. And I will admit, I did vote for him, and this is kind of the first thing, this first encounter of, like, you know, the guy you voted for doing something you totally disagree with. And if we had Alex here, this discussion would be...
Did you expect him to do otherwise, John?
He said he was going to
Not necessarily.
This. Yes. Because this is, you know, you try to vote for somebody who carefully considers their decisions, and a little bit of careful consideration and looking into the issue would lead you kind of to a different course of action, even if you're for stricter standards.
But that's why I want to be clear, though, that this is so early. This is so not a closed case. This is the first step of this, and we don't know what's going to happen next. If everything goes according to normal, you know, politics that we know and hate, then yes, the EPA will approve it and everything will go down that path. But I don't know that will happen. I don't know that because Obama just made this request that it's going to go the course that everybody expects. Something could happen between now and later that shows us, you know, the thoughtful consideration that Dan and I are hoping for, and that maybe the EPA does have a compromise or a different solution that we haven't thought of, because this isn't the EPA that we knew 6 months ago. This is a different one. So,
hey, Sam.
Here's hoping for that. But
hey, Sam.
Yeah.
Do you remember those old emissions tests that we had to do in Michigan for many years? You had to get your
dude. I have to do them right now. I just did it for the show.
Them in Massachusetts.
Yeah, and at the show passed. Yeah. Hello.
Excellent.
You know, that's the thing I'm wondering is, like, you know, do we make everybody who passes this higher standard, are they going to have to go and reach a higher standard, or are they going to be able to use their old car? Because when they see the price of a mid-sized car that gets 45 miles per gallon, they're going to have a heart attack. And they're not going to buy it.
Well, see,
you can't make an emissions standard retroactive.
Whenever standards have been raised, you know, when you've had to do emissions tests, the emissions tests have always, you had to meet whatever standard was in place at the time the car was built.
But you see, even a much older car, if it's properly maintained and in proper tune, it's going to be pretty darn clean when it's warmed up. And I'm not talking about like a Ford flathead from 1950.
Right.
I mean, that's obviously going to be dirtier.
Anything built, you know, from, you know, 1990
Anything
onwards.
In the last 20 years, yeah. It's going to be very clean once it's warmed up. And that first 10 minutes of running
not,
is going to be the dirtiest
that.
Period.
It's like, you know, about the first two and a half minutes, you know, really to warm up the catalytic converter.
You know, much bigger problem is, you know, a car that's not maintained. And there is no tune-up anymore either. I mean, that's a fallacy. I mean, but you need to, you know, I get behind cars that belch smoke, and they're just obviously not running properly. They have rejection stickers on their windshield because they failed emissions tests, and people are still driving them around. So, you know, close those loopholes, and it's much less expensive to maintain your vehicle, as a general rule, than to buy something new. But then you get in the whole point of, you know, the emotional purchase, and, you know, people are reactive where they're driving an SUV and gas shoots up to $4.50 a gallon, and they immediately trade it on a Civic versus just, you know, trying to drive less.
All right, we've already exhausted 45 minutes of podcasting, and while nobody ever complains about how long our podcasts are, they only complain when they're short, we're going to move on anyway. And I did want to, Sam, you had a good point before we started the podcast. We were talking about the fact that the hybrids actually went down 9.9% during 2008. So that kind of shows that as gas prices went down, whatever, that Prius and whatever demand, it just died with it. So kind of expound on what you said.
I mean, it didn't entirely die. I mean, you know, when gas prices went down, you know, the demand for those vehicles did drop. But, you know, they also got hurt really bad by the you know, economic meltdown in the last 3 months of the year. Yeah, just well, as everybody else did. But, you know,
did the battery shortages they were experiencing kind of set up the expectation, like, oh, you won't be able to get one of those? So,
no, I mean, you know, I mean, in the spring, you know, when gas was $3.50 to $4 a gallon, you know, Toyota, you know, was selling the Priuses as fast as they could build them and bring them over from Japan, which was a rate of about 15,000 cars a month.
Which was less than what they were producing and selling the year before, so it showed up as a sales drop month to month.
It's less because what happened was the year before, they had had some excess inventory when the tax credits expired on the Prius.
They built up to satisfy
The sales had dropped in the months before that, and so there was some extra inventory available. And then when gas prices started to go up in 2007, you know, people started buying more of them. You know, Toyota offered some incentives on them, and so they, you know, they had a spike in sales, you know, which was above and beyond the actual build rate that they were producing them at. And then, you know, as they got into the, you know, early part of 2008, that extra inventory got depleted, and they settled in at a 15,000 vehicle per month rate. Which was, you know, that was the limit of their capacity, you know, with batteries and everything else.
Now, Sam, back in November,
It dropped by 50%. Right, you know, it dropped to 7,500.
Right when I'm setting it up is back in November we gasped when Chrysler's sales month numbers came up for the month down 51%. I mean, by far the worst we saw of everything, but yet the Prius, which is incredibly highly regarded. I mean, juxtapose the Chrysler lineup. I don't think any Chrysler vehicle comes close to the esteem that the Prius has. Yet it was down 50%, just like and there were no battery shortages. They were going through the same economic downturn as everybody else. Knowing that Toyota has a much higher regard than Chrysler, and
the Prius was not the only Toyota that had a 50% sales drop either.
Right, but my point is, the Tundra
had even bigger drops.
Back to what John was saying earlier. The market will determine fuel efficient. Now, the price of gas was $1.78 in November, maybe $2 tops, and you've got people just saying, you know what, I don't need one now. Truck sales were up. I mean, month to month from October, they were up. So the Prius all of a sudden just falls on its face that flat fast, which again says to me, gas tax. Do you want to fix things? Gas tax.
Yeah, but also, though, I mean, note that, you know, I wrote the post, and this is one of those things that I didn't kind of look at, but, you know, total vehicle sales were off for the year about 20% versus the hybrid sales, which were only down about 10%. So they still, overall, they didn't get hurt as badly.
Right, but take out May through July.
Right,
and
but
see what happens.
You've got that, and then on the backside of it, you've got gas dropping, and then economic hardships getting worse. So it's kind of like a double whammy for the second half of the year. So overall, you know, they're still selling. They're not, it's not like people have just totally decided that
Sam,
now gas is cheap. So
Sam, can you guesstimate what percentage the Prius is of total hybrid sales in the U.S.?
Oh,
I would say it's the majority by far.
Between 70 and 75% of all hybrids.
So all right, so it's Prius. Pretty much what, you know, the Prius is pretty much what we're talking about. I mean, the
it
last 25% is divided among, you know, 15 other hybrids.
Yeah, I mean, the next biggest one is the Escape and Mariner.
Yeah, about 10% of
them.
Yeah,
so, I mean, off after that.
If you look at the total, if hybrid sales as a whole dropped 10% last year and total vehicle sales dropped 20%, and we're mainly talking about the Prius here with the hybrids, it makes total sense to me because in the summer they got a boost from high gas prices before the economic meltdown, and then in the economic meltdown, all car sales fell, and the Prius and other hybrids got the double whammy of the economic meltdown and the drop in gas prices, but they were bolstered from the summer sales when gas was high before everybody...
Right, and you know, truck sales took a dive earlier in the year and then stayed comparatively low. It bounced back a little bit, but not nearly enough to make up for what they lost in the first half of the year.
Right. Part of it is...
Well, I think there was a residual kind of pain felt for truck sales. I think people were really scared to go back into trucks and large SUVs, even though gas was below $2 a gallon, because I think everybody knows now, the price of gas is like the temperature in Cleveland during the winter. You know, it's going to go up and it's going to go down and it's going to yo-yo now. I think people are used to that.
It's mostly going
to
suck. And I think, which is kind of like the weather in Cleveland.
It's going to suck the whole time. Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Well, don't forget too that don't forget that what is also being really horribly affected by the economic downturn is the construction and housing business, which is a huge consumer
of
trucks.
Right, which also screws the truck segment.
But you guys remember back in 2005, that employee pricing thing that, totally threw off car sales for like 8 months? Basically, over the summer when gas was $4 a gallon, Priuses of the world, all the fuel-efficient vehicles, even the Civics, were basically they had their employee pricing problem, and then people bought them up like crazy, all that they could buy. And then afterwards, some of the people that were going to buy Priuses or Civics bought them early because they were freaked out. So there was going to be a little bit of a deflation in demand on top of the fact that gas was $2 a gallon now. And there was a problem with the economic downturn.
You know, the funny thing is, in the last 4 months, my parents and my brother-in-law and his wife both bought brand new Priuses. Like, despite the economic downturn, despite $2 a gallon gas, like, it was time for both of them to get a new car, and they just said to themselves, it's going to happen again with gas. Why should I get something that's, going to get 20 miles per gallon or 25 when I can get something that's going to get 40 on its worst day? At this point, when you have incentives on a Prius in January, why not?
Civic. I can get the Civic, or I'd wait for the Fusion.
But if you actually enjoy the act of driving, the Prius is the last place you want to be.
Which neither my parents nor my brother-in-law really care about, and which is why I quietly whispered Pontiac G8 GT in their ear, but they did not listen one bit.
Your dad owns a motorhome thing. I mean, come on, how fuel efficient can the guy be?
Well, it was my mom's. It ended up being my mom's car. My dad would never buy a new car. He drives like a 1994 Saturn SL2.
Yeah, and soon he's going to be driving a 99 Alero.
No, I sold the Alero tonight.
You did.
Yeah, and actually, funny enough, my dad sold it for me to his mechanic's son. Who's going to buy it off me.
Did you sign a dashboard so he knows it was John Neff's car?
Yeah, I don't even think he reads Autoblog.
He's a mechanic son, for crying out loud. He loves cars.
No, he's into violin.
I'm just happy I don't have to deal with putting it in the paper or anything. And he's going to fix it up a little. So it lives on. I'm still waiting for the weather to freaking break in Cleveland. It's been like sub 20 degrees for like 25 days straight. And all I want to do is take off some decals and switch out the grill on the SHO, take it out for a nice photo shoot so I can, have it coming out. It's debutante party.
You're tired
on Autoblog.
Of just talking to it?
I seriously, when I go out for a smoke break now, I just go into the garage and stare at it. Oh, I drove it the other day because I took it to get a car wash. So I got to drive it for the second time. And it was cool. It was awesome. Loved it. Great on the highway, but the roads in my city, because my city is like a dense area, a lot of young people and probably lower middle class. The roads are horrible, and an 18-year-old vehicle on these roads is just terrifying, the shakes and the rattles. But I get out to like the rich suburbs where everything's smooth, and it's great.
There you go.
All right.
So what else are we covering?
Yeah, there is the fact that Toyota is reporting that they're down to $18.5 billion in cash, which to me is rather astonishing given the fact that it seemed like they had $100 billion or $90 billion, I think John McElroy said, in the bank a couple years ago, and now all of a sudden they are in the same position as Ford as far as cash goes.
Well, they've been pushing hard, though. They're building a Prius plant in the U.S. and a bunch of other stuff, so...
Not anymore.
Yeah, they built a lot of capacity.
Yeah, several new assembly plants in the States and other plants in other parts of the world, you know, plus developing, you know, the Tundra and Sequoia and the new Prius and the Lexus HS250 and all, you know, all these other vehicles.
You know who else is building a lot of plants around the world is General Motors. I think they've built something like 7 plants around the world.
Well, that's because they're doing well everywhere else
in
the world,
except the
US. Right,
but I mean, if you think about it, the cost of a plant isn't much different in Bupyong as it is in Mississippi.
Yeah, but you know
what?
How
do you say that?
GM runs the same way as every big corporation, just like AOL, and since I deal with Autoblog's owners, AOL, on a daily basis, you know, one division spreadsheet has nothing to do with the others, so the budgets are separated, so you can't really go to
they're
GM
going
and
global,
say,
John, you
you're
didn't
stupid.
Hear?
You're stupid for building, you know, 8 plants around the world when you could be spending all that money in the home. It's kind of like, you know what? They're different budgets.
No,
they're
John,
different
you're wrong with GM, because I know for a fact that they have to ask corporate before. It's corporate's idea to build car plants around the world. The regions are very small entities. The actual people in North America are the ones that make the decisions on this stuff. And my point is, the fact of the matter is that GM has been losing a lot of money. Toyota suddenly is losing money. They're both building a lot of plants, and the two companies are a lot more alike than I think, especially Toyota, would like to admit. I mean...
Sure, but I guess my point is that GM isn't losing money because it's building plants in foreign markets, whereas Toyota decided to build a giant Tundra plant at the worst possible time ever. And that really hurt them. GM is smart for building plants in other markets, emerging ones, where it's doing well and it's selling cars and it's, you know, earning a profit in those countries. So in this case, I would say, even though they're looking a lot alike, GM's the smarter one because let's build another Silverado plant.
You've got to take momentum into account. And when they started that Tundra plant, things were a lot different than they are now. So,
well, of course, they had no idea. I mean, I'm not saying they had a crystal ball and, you know, didn't know how to use it, but I'm just saying that, you know, The fact is, Toyota made, in retrospect, a move they would probably choose not to if they had to do it over today. I mean, would you build right now, you know, a plant devoted solely to the production of a full-size truck in Texas? No, I wouldn't even develop the truck.
What amazes me is that Toyota didn't have a crystal ball, but it almost seems like Honda did. Because Honda did, it's almost like they planned for this to happen. I mean...
Well, that's because Honda's run by, like, wizards and magicians. Honda does not follow the trends of, you know, the winds of the trends. They build cars that almost seem against the flow of what the market is asking for. They do it so well, and then they wait for the market to turn.
Yeah, but, you drive a Honda vehicle?
No, I mean, they have built some cars that were, you know, less than successful in the marketplace.
And some ugly designs, too.
They don't give up on them.
Don't forget the ugly designs. Yeah.
Yes, they don't give up on them, and you can't say that they're bad cars.
No, they're generally sublime. Every Honda I've been in, from the Pilot down to the S2000, they all have a certain Honda-ness to them that, you know, is almost like a core thread that runs through their business, their philosophy, and that keeps them out of making things like a full-frame truck. They'll go with the Ridgeline, but they won't go, you know, they're not going to go further than that.
I came across an amazing stat. You know, everybody thinks of Car and Driver's 10 best lists, and you think BMW, right, because it's always on there. But Honda has twice as many 10 best nominations as any other automaker, bar none.
Right. Well, the Accord's been on it for like 25 years. The BMWs
haven't really... 78 total.
They're... Yeah. And the first BMW to get on that list, I believe, was the E36 back in the 90s when it came out. So up until that point, it had always been the Accord show on the 10 best list. And I don't think there's been a 10 best where the Accord hasn't
been
on the
list.
I may be mistaken.
Beyond the Accord, there's another 50. And nobody else even has 40.
Well, yeah. What makes it up? The Civic?
I mean, when you look through
probably.
The list,
yeah,
you see
cars
the,
like Civic,
the Civic,
Prelude,
the, NSX,
Prelude, the I mean, the Civic.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a slew of different models that have made the list over the years.
I mean, it just shows how good of a company it has been consistently for decades.
Like I said, they do their own thing, and no matter what the product is, they do it well to the standards they set for themselves, not what, you know, a focus group sets or anything like that. So at the end of the day, I think every Honda engineer is proud of what they've done, regardless of how the vehicle sells.
Well, I think Honda is a company of engineers larger than any other company. It's permeated by more of an engineer culture, I think. And I'd be interested to find out.
By engineers.
It would be interesting to see, because I know, like, my brother's an engineer, and they have two Hondas. I guarantee you that more engineers and their families own Hondas than probably any other vehicle.
They have to be thinking, damn designers right now, the engineers, because they have good engineers there, and the designers not so much. All right, you said the S2000 and the S2000 and the Cadillac XLR both went on the firing range today, if we were reading an autoblog at all. Both vehicles, fun to drive, I mean, kind of cool cars, gone from the face of the earth.
Well, and again, we should point out that the S2000 was officially announced by Honda. The Cadillac hasn't been officially killed, but the report came out of the Bowling Green Daily News that it would cease production.
That's what the plan is. That makes the XLR, so...
Right. Yeah, and I say sad day for both. Both are good cars in their own right. The XLR was just horribly priced, way far out of its range. But that doesn't mean it was a bad car. I liked it. I reviewed the XLR-V recently, the 2009 model, and just I fell in love with it. It was so charming to me. It just did. It just kind of charmed me over the way it sounded, the way it drove, the way it looked, especially, even though this is like the first generation of the Cadillac art and science design, and it never really got a chance for a redesign. Its two major flaws was, A, it never got a Corvette engine. You know, it always made do with the Northstar V8 and it's a supercharged version of the Northstar in the XLR-V. And it was just so ridiculously priced. The XLR-V I had was over $100,000. It was the most expensive Cadillac, but would get its ass kicked by a CTS-V that cost $40,000 less.
Yeah, and it's really difficult to get into an XLR with replacement hips.
It's kind of hard to get into a CTS-V with replacement hips too, though.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, but see, mess up the joke there.
But Sam's the engineer; he's going to do that. I'm looking on eBay right now, and they've got a XLR 2004 with 39,000 miles on it for $24,000. So, you're talking about $50,000 off stickers, you know, and you're only losing 40,000 miles of its lifespan. I guarantee it's going to run for 150. So, I mean, when you look at it like used XLRs, it's a really thrilling prospect. When I see the new ones, I'm not that excited because I'd seriously much rather have a Corvette.
Well, the only one I'd consider is the new XLR-V. I think, you know, it's got the styling, just a little bit of of the few styling tweaks they did for 2009, and the engine I want. That's probably the only one I'd go for, so I'm going to wait like 15 years and then add it to my collection of quirky cars that never made it.
You need an XLR with the LSA engine from the CTS-V in it.
Yeah, hell yeah. I mean, that would have made sense. Look, it's just a matter of...
That would be just shy of a ZR1.
What happened to the XLR is just a matter of GM running out of turnaround money and not being able to kind of fix or take this car to the next step. The CTS got taken to the next step. It got taken to the next level.
Two levels.
With a redesigned model.
Yeah, but I think the CTS-V, you know, probably sells more units in a year than the XLR has sold in its entire production.
Oh, absolutely.
Line.
Absolutely. But they had to let the XLR wither on the vine. They just didn't have enough money to go out on that limb for a low volume, you know, grand touring hardtop convertible. And it's understandable. It's just a shame because it was a nice idea that just they didn't have the money to carry through.
You know, if Cadillac had built the XLR back in the 80s when they built the original Elante instead, it would probably, you know, it would be as much of a classic today as the SL is. Yeah.
Well, the Elante had what, that sucky 4-liter V8 that was never right from the start until they came out with the Northstar for the last year. And
the Elante never should have been built on the, you know, the old front wheel drive Eldorado platform. That was the problem.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it should have always been built on a Corvette platform.
Oh yeah, because a C4 Corvette would have been a really nice caddy.
Would have been better than the Eldorado.
Well, we can argue that, and as revisionist historians, I suppose.
Well, I said that at the time, though.
Yeah, you have to remember that Sam actually had his driver's license back then, so...
Yeah, that's true. I'm trying to remember, like, how old...
What year was that? Well, he had a real job, too, I'm sure.
Well, he still has a real job.
I was a busboy, and I didn't have my driver's license yet.
I think I was watching Voltron or something.
I was in college at the time.
Thundercats!
John's go! In the kitchen in hushed tones saying, is he ever going to get out of the house?
Wait, what, like, what year is that? What are we talking about?
Yeah. Well, there he is at Subway, honey. He's fine.
Well, all right.
All day. Okay, go on.
So what about the S2000 then?
The S2000 I will certainly lament much more than the XLR. That car is nearly, you know, it's like an amplified MX-5. It's just one of those vehicles you drive and you go, oh, this is what they mean when they say it handles as an extension of yourself. I just wish they made a closed version of it.
I never had much contact with it, so I can't say either way, but I will say it leaves a pretty big performance void in Honda's lineup, and somebody asked me today, is Honda going to become like Toyota, where it has nothing left, it's just an appliance maker? Because I think, what does Honda have left? The SI, and that's it?
Yeah, but I think it's different, though, in Honda's case, because, you know, even though the cars that they're still building, you know, generally aren't overtly sporty, you know, cars like the Fit, you know, are still dynamically far superior than their counterparts at Toyota. You know, I mean, the Fit is a much more fun car to drive than you know, mm-hmm. any comparable small car
the
from
Aris,
Toyota.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Yes, he's serious. Well, I think to your point, Sam, Honda just bakes in a minimum level of fun to drive,
right?
Of like you said, you know, dynamics into every single one of its cars. That is kind of above the median of the rest of the industry, but still, it's kind of, you know, that's kind of why I have such an attachment to the automakers, to the domestic automakers, because they seem to know how to have a good time even in the worst of times. Because we have the Mustang and we have the Challenger and we have the Camaro. Yeah. Yeah, it's called a V8. It's called, you know, that, you know, Ford clung to the Mustang through the 90s. You know, even when the Camaro and the F bodies went away. And it's like they still always had a performance flag to wave, and that's what I kind of appreciate about them. You know, maybe it's to their detriment at
right,
some point.
If you think about like the Japanese automakers, the sportier they are, the less successful they are. So I mean, like if you like the least sporty is Toyota. Then there's Honda, and then there's Nissan, and then there's Mazda and Mitsubishi. The lower you get.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah,
it's like, well, we're just going to get a niche here. And it's like, well,
because they become more of a niche. Because, you know, people that are buying a Japanese performance vehicle, more in the lines of like a, you know, a Nissan, like the Nismo Z or something, they're looking for something more particular than just, you know, the person who goes, I want something sporty, and they just fall on the Mustang as the lowest common denominator. I mean,
yeah, a lot of people buy a Mustang outside the performance.
You know, we're all outliers. You know, most people when they go buy a car, they don't give a shit how it drives. They just want it
but
to
Sam,
work.
But Sam, if they at least because they don't at least know any better to us first in most instances. I mean,
hopefully.
They try, and like you whispered the G8 thing. I mean, right. you were looking out for their best instances. You wanted them to be happy. I mean, your brother-in-law's not happy. He's a Prius owner.
Well, you know, no, but that's what I mean. Seriously, though, at the time, they came to me and asked, you know, what should I get if I want the highest fuel economy possible that, you know, I can still use as a normal car? What can you say other than the
Jetta
Prius?
TDI?
You know, it's a 4-door sedan.
No, Jetta TDI. You know,
not if you want to pay out the nose for diesel fuel. You know,
my house, it's like 20 cents difference.
Maybe where you are.
It's within 20 cents now. I didn't even realize that happened, but it happened like in the last month or so.
And you know, frankly, I do always mention the Jetta TDI, but at the same time, I also want them to have a reliable car. Which
are
you know, I'm going to recommend
about Volkswagen,
it.
John?
Yeah, you're right there.
Your family member,
it's just not going to be a very good Thanksgiving. Whenever they're yelling at you for
if a dead TDI, dead TDI.
When somebody comes to you and they ask you about a specific car or a specific type of car, they want to be talked into it. They want to, you know,
right.
Get
they
that
don't
want
to know what you think they should get. They want you to make them feel better about what they've already picked in their head.
That is so true.
And that's what I hate, because they ask me and I roll stuff out, you know, I give them five options and it comes back to the first car they mentioned. And I'm like, yeah. You know, somebody once asked me, you know, what they should buy, and they were talking to me about the Saturn View, and it was the version of the View before this current redesigned one. And I told them, well, you know, they're coming out with a new redesigned one in a year if you could wait. And if you really wanted, you get the CRV. And they were a Saturn person. They just wanted me to tell them that it was okay to get that Saturn View. And do you know how hard it was for me to, like, make them feel good about getting that version of the View? I think the only thing I came up with was that the engine was made by Honda.
I'm sure once they actually owned that version of the View, it was probably difficult for them to feel good about it as well.
You know what the worst
part is? But Sam said, they don't know the difference. They don't know what a CRV drives like, or they don't know what a better, you know, all they want to do is feel good about what they're
You know what the worst part is, John? You know, they're looking at the View, and their friend's looking at the View, and they say, oh, it's a pretty nice car. Yeah, I talked to my my brother-in-law, John Neff. He runs Autoblog. Yeah, he said it's a good
He recommended it. He said it's a great vehicle. Yeah. Honestly, though, when people... I do get asked a lot about what I should buy next, and I let people talk for 5 minutes, I nod my head, and then say, you know, whatever you're going to be happy with in your driveway at the end of the day is what you should get.
Right.
And, you know, if you really want to listen to what I'm saying, go ahead. But at the end of the day, you just get whatever makes you happy.
You did that to me,
man. It's your money.
Don't care what I say.
Oh. Yeah, but when
well, maybe that's why you have an S40 in your driveway.
Yeah, well, and that's why John, like, every few weeks when he decides he wants something new, you know, you don't take your own advice, though. You let us talk you in and out of cars. It was
dude,
the
I will
Mustang,
never buy a
Focus,
used European or German car because of you, Dan. I'm so scared of getting
The old ones are great, but the anything after 99 or 2000, yeah, you gotta
I'd
have
push
a lot
it back
of money
a few years more than
them.
That, too.
Yeah.
I totally listened to you guys, and then I completely disregarded what you said and got a 91 Taurus.
That's okay. You probably got the only Taurus in Cleveland that's not rusty yet.
Oh, that thing's not going to get rusty. It's going to be in his bathtub before it gets rusty.
Yeah, no, it is safely tucked away and will not go outside until this weather, something happens. I need global warming to start.
Well, just let it idle then.
John sings it a lullaby every night before he goes to bed, and then he sings it again in Japanese so the engine can fall asleep.
Right.
Speaking of this cold weather, one thing I do want to mention about the Tahoe that I had, one really, really nice feature, when you use the remote start, it actually turns on the seat heaters on
yeah, it does. I like that.
When it's cold out.
Yeah, yeah, another thing that I couldn't get to work on the Escalade.
You know, the Dodge Ram did that, too. The Ram pickup.
You know, the Escalade has that tantalizing little button on the fob, the little circle button that's remote start. I'll hold it for 5 minutes.
Double-click it, second one
you
hold it down.
Lock the doors first. Lock the doors first, and then press it for about 3 or 4 seconds, and
you don't even have to do that on the Ram. Okay. The Ram, it'll lock the doors itself right when you do it. You can unlock it, then press the button, and it'll lock the doors for you.
I figured it had to be just me being too stupid,
You told me last week that it didn't have a navigation system. I'm like, no, I'm pretty sure it does. But now,
I mean, I pressed every button on that stupid console, and I couldn't get the map to show up. So I was like, all right, I must not have nav. I'm driving, so I'm not paying that much attention.
The 9/11 last fall, it came without any DVDs for the nav system. It had the nav system, and it just didn't have the discs in it.
So you programmed it from scratch?
Oh, no.
God, Sam, come on.
No, he got the old school nav system. It's called a map.
Dies, right?
I just went and found some roads. It was a 9/11. Yeah, what do you want? Who needs to know where you're going as long as you're going somewhere?
All right, let's talk about one more thing, and it's actually pretty important, and we're already at an hour here.
We're over an hour.
God, are we ever? We're at an hour and 10
74 minutes.
Right.
Minutes.
Let's talk about this Chrysler-Fiat partnership. 7 new models. John, we'll start with you. What are they bringing over here?
Well, the 500 for one thing, which is, you know,
the 500 as the 500, if you will, or the 500 as a Chrysler version of the 500?
Well, what they say is that they're going to give some production capacity in Mexico to Fiat to build it, and I believe it is for sale in the U.S. As to whether it's branded a Chrysler or not, I can't believe they branded a Chrysler.
I think they're saying they'll actually sell both a Fiat branded 500 and then a Chrysler vehicle on the 500 platform. So
I have a question though: isn't the Ford Fiesta based on the same platform as the 500 too?
The Ford Ka is on.
Oh, the Ford Ka. Okay, because that would be funny if like three vehicles from three brands were all in the same.
Yeah, when I saw that report. Yeah, you know, because last fall Mullally was saying he'd like to bring the Ka to the U.S. market, and if
he did,
it would be funny if through Fiat and Chrysler we ended up getting the Ka as well.
Right. Well, God, I mean, wouldn't that facilitate Ford doing it? Just saying to Chrysler, we'll pay a little fee and build some Kas for
absolutely.
Us too. Yeah, it would make sense. So other vehicles, they don't really say specifics. All they say is of the seven vehicles, four will be under the Chrysler brand and three as either Alfa Romeos or Fiats. They say it covers four platforms spanning
the
microcars, the midsize sedans.
Me too.
That'll be one of them?
Yeah.
Or that's on the platform?
No, that's one of the four vehicles.
Didn't they say there was going to be a midsize? Or is that, were they talking C segment midsize or not D segment? Because
yeah, well, there was the Me Too, the Punto, which would be the C-segment car, and then an enlarged version of that, which would be the midsize car.
So there's your Project D. Is that Project
awesome.
D right there? Case closed?
That's the new iteration of Project D, yeah.
Yeah, might as well just light all the calipers on
Project
fire.
Project D, January edition.
Yeah.
Yeah, throw out the old plan. Time to start over again.
If anything, at least it'll inject some style into the automotive landscape that's kind of lacking. They're all, they may be not as striking in Europe where things tend to have the kind of style that these cars are going to carry, but we don't have stuff like this here, so it's
are you guys
exciting.
Looking at the post, right, the photo on the bottom left? It looks like kind of like a scrunch Sirocco. What is that?
Hold on.
Is that the Grande Punto bar?
Yeah, I think that's
okay.
The Punto.
I'm not a big Fiat fan, but
and that's Scirocco.
Whatever.
Chris.
I'm not a big fan of that either. And that is a cool looking car.
Wait a minute. What you talking about? The white one?
Yeah.
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 That's a cool looking car.
Yeah, on the Mito or Me Too or however you pronounce it.
I think it's pronounced Me Too.
That's awfully slick looking, and the 500 obviously is gonna,
and the Panda's pretty cool.
Yeah,
I mean the Panda's like an SX4,
and from what I understand the Panda is like you can just pound and pound and pound on it, which you weren't able to do on the older Fiat vehicles. They just would break all the time, so hopefully they've been out of the market long enough to overcome that whole fix it again Tony stigma and grab a new generation of buyers that don't remember the vehicles from what they were in the bad old days.
I mean, based on this report, I can absolutely see why Chrysler wants to do this deal. This basically gives Chrysler a complete bottom half to its lineup.
Yeah, which
it
totally obviously didn't have. It's sorely lacking.
Yeah, it had nothing. It was amazing that it was even around and had nothing below the Caliber, and to call the Caliber its
Yikes.
Smallest car is ridiculous. The Caliber is on the large
right.
side of small cars. And obviously they had large cars taken care of and trucks and SUVs, to the hilt. But this gives them a completely fleshed out small lineup from micro cars to C-segment cars.
And you know what? I think Fiat's getting a pretty decent deal here. At first, when I first saw it, I'm like, well, gee, what is Fiat getting? They're not getting any of the debt of Chrysler. They're not getting any of the bad parts. And they're getting, a U.S. channel. They're getting a V6.
Right, it gets a welcome back to the U.S. market.
They're going
to
get some economies of scale.
Exactly, they're getting scale. They're getting all the things that an automaker in Europe that isn't here wants at the same time.
Well, and they're getting Chrysler's expertise about how to get automobiles in and around this country to dealerships, which they'd have to kind of learn all over again if they were.
And, for whatever other problems Chrysler's had recently with product development, they have managed to nail down the process of building cars efficiently.
Right. They know how to do it. Well, Chrysler knows how to do all this. It's just a matter of, you know, them kind of focusing and losing their train of thought on certain aspects of it. But
yeah, like what's cars are supposed to look like?
Right, exactly.
Sebring, duh. They even named it after a cool race.
But I mean, and right now, wouldn't you say that Fiat is one of the most progressive brands in Europe in terms of design? I mean, they have some of the most beautiful designs, you know, in the Punto and the Bravo. And then you go to Alfa Romeo, obviously, and that's off the charts in terms of style. And that's what I think Chrysler needs to tap back into. Chrysler used to be the king of putting passion into its designs.
Yeah, but all those people jump ship when you know, all the deals happened. You know, they lost Tom Gale, and they lost a lot of their talent that was responsible for making Chrysler such a style leader. So
maybe Fiat will let them borrow some. I don't know.
Yeah. It could be worse. I mean, it'd be really nice.
You know,
to
judging
see
from
it,
the 200C concept, you know, they've obviously still got some people in there who know.
Right,
how
somebody's
to design a car.
Somebody's still around.
Yeah. So can you imagine that bodywork on a you know, European tuned platform?
Hell yeah! Then I'd be you know trumpeting
to keep
Chrysler's comeback,
around.
But.
And with the Vaporware Phoenix V6 that apparently Fiat's chomping at the bit for, which I'm sure it sounds marvelous on paper. I'd love to see it and try it out. But
you know,
apparently,
you know,
that's
the funny
one of
thing
the
is, though,
Fiat benefits. You know.
The funny thing is that all the stuff that GM and Chrysler are going through, you know, these are sins they're going to have to pay for in the marketplace and in public opinion. Even if Chrysler comes out of this with great products, I think consumers are going to remember this horrible patch that Chrysler has gone through, and much of it, of course, being blamed on Chrysler itself. And GM's going to have to go through the same thing. Justifiably so.
Yeah, I mean,
GM's going to have to go through the same thing. But look at this. Ford isn't. If everybody makes it through this, Ford is going to come out looking like roses. Yeah, and GM and Chrysler are going to be kind of have this huge weight on their back of, yay, we may have good products now after all of this is over, but we kind of, you know, royally screwed ourselves and asked for, you know, you to help bail us out.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, Ford mortgaged himself to the hilt preemptively. I remember talking about that back before things kind of really... When Mullally came on, he kind of looked at everything and was like, all right, let's borrow some money. And that's obviously turned out to be a good thing, but you know, people have long memories, not necessarily accurate memories. So they still talk about how
right.
Chrysler was bailed out in the early 80s, and they weren't bailed out. They were loans, and they were paid back early with interest. So, you know, it depends on how the court of public opinion is turned. Look at all the flack Chrysler took for taking out thank you ads, and it's, you know.
Well, that's what I mean. It? I think that's going to linger, especially in Chrysler's case. And even, you know, I see GM coming out with good product, and I think they're going to be
I wish
probably
Chrysler
okay.
coming out with good product.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, Chrysler going through this, at least GM can say, yes, we have to borrow money, but look at the products we're offering. They're really class competitive. They're world class now. Chrysler's going through this, and they're borrowing money to stay alive and trying to sell you Calibers
Yikes.
And Sebrings at the same time. You can't do that and expect to come out unscathed.
But to,
so
be,
even
to
if,
be fair
even if
to Chrysler,
years,
they have an entirely competitive pickup truck. They have some good large cars. They've got the Challenger, which is in a segment that was hot. And,
those are exactly not the cars you want to have
now. No, they don't have the core of their business. And I think that's why it seems like we take an awful lot of shots at Chrysler. I think that's why, because they've got the fringe taken care of, except, you know, they've got the meat and potatoes pickup truck. And
well, it's not that they got the fringe. They have the segments taken care of that you wanted to have taken care of in 1997.
Right.
You know, the segments you want to have taken care of today are the hybrid segments and the small car segment, all those things that make you look
good. Well, but see, they had those segments. Well, they had the small cars in the 90s with the Neon, and they had, you know, the LH cars, which were truly the class of the domestic midsize vehicles, you know, against what? The funky third-generation Taurus and the W-platform Lumina? I mean, come on. An Intrepid is a lot more compelling. So they've really fallen from grace in that sense. They could learn a lot by looking at themselves 15 years ago.
All I'm saying is they got to take what Fiat gives them and freaking knock it out of the park to overcome the baggage that they're going to exit, you know, this current environment.
I thought the Hornet looked good. Give me the Hornet. Give me a B car that looks like the Hornet.
Yeah, I mean, put a Hornet body on the Me Too platform. Or even on the 500 platform?
I wonder.
They should take the Panda and make an M80.
I wonder if that Nissan deal.
I've always wanted the M80.
The Hornet is still on. I mean, did that dissolve all this?
I doubt it. I mean, it still is.
Yeah, this isn't. I mean, since this isn't really like an ownership thing, I'm sure Chrysler is going to be pursuing all of its partnerships still if it can. I'm sure they're still talking to Nissan. And of course they are, because obviously they're going to be doing the commercial stuff and the Ram and the Titan still. So, and of course they still sell the Versa as a Dodge in like South America somewhere,
yeah.
Brazil or something.
Sweet. I'm done.
And on that note,
Yeah, it's almost midnight. We have to go.
Boy, when we hit a wall, we hit a wall.
I was just filled with a sense of dread. I'm like, wow, what happened?
Hey, when are we gonna do another listener question podcast? That was fun.
Whenever you want. We're still getting email questions in. So yeah, I missed the last one. I can't wait till we do the next one.
I think in a couple weeks we could do more, but we'll split it up a little bit different. I think that just for once is the entire show is question and answer, but I think we could mix it up a little better, because look what happens. We got an hour and 25 minute podcast because we just did questions last week.
we could throw a couple questions in at the end of a normal podcast, or do an all question one every month or so.
We're definitely gonna address a couple questions, so don't let me forget. And it's podcast@autoblog.com.
I was just about to say.
All right, good night.
Good night, everybody.
Take care.
Holla.